radio, Tufts Freeform, commercial-free, community-based radio, and these headphones are not working. Let's see. Do I have the wrong headphones? Yes, I do. Sorry about that. We're airing our dirty laundry here of technical problems. And the Ear Buddies is leaving the house. Thanks for the help, Ear Buddies. And they had a Cinco de Mayo show. And I'm so ignorant about Cinco de Mayo, or I'm losing my memory, one or the other. I think it had a political root to it. Wasn't it chasing the French out of Mexico? But I could be totally wrong about that. Don't call. Don't quote me. I will look it up. I'll Google it. Don't worry. So today, you're about to switch gears a little bit with our station and join us in a two-hour odyssey of talk and music. And that is Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. And we're here every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And we are pleased to be here. It's just going to be myself, Jeff, your host today. And we are going to talk about the aftermath of the Stop and Shop worker strike. A victory by most accounts, and but you know, there's some things to look into that could have gone better, but overall a victory, and we hope that in many ways, and we hope that workers will get the idea that, gee, if they did it, we can do it, meaning go out and strike if you're already in a union to get what you need, what you want, or to just organize into a union if you're not in a union. And it's interesting because the I've already seen on Facebook, somebody shared an anti-union company propaganda poster, quite lengthy. It would be fun to just sit there and read it, you know, extend your break by reading the anti-union propaganda from the company, from Hannaford's. This was a Hannaford's up in Maine. Now, Hannaford's is owned by the same company that owns Stop and Shop. And so some Hannaford's up in Maine, they put up this anti-union propaganda right after the Stop and Shop strike ended. Because most people are seeing it as a victory, and like I said, in many ways it is. And they put up these posters, and of course, you know, the kind of Facebook stuff I get. I must be on the socialist algorithm for Facebook, because I get a lot of really good shares from people, from other socialists, basically revolutionary socialists and people that want to change things, union activists that are political. Yeah, there's some great pages. One of them is like Reds in the Union. Another one is sort of like union thugs, you know, making fun of the propaganda against unions. Really great stuff. And I hope the workers up there in Maine, I didn't get the town they were in, but I hope they will get a good laugh out of the anti-union propaganda. Because, you know, if the company spends that much time writing up that stuff, and it's all this stuff about how we're a family and we don't want this outside entity, a union, to come in, ignoring the fact that a union is the workers in the union. Now, if you're in a union like I am, and I've been in three different unions and helped organize unions and stuff, if you are in a union, that might sound funny, because sometimes you can have a union where the leadership is kind of raised itself above the membership, both in terms of their salaries and in terms of their they just want, you know, concede things to management when they don't have to get along with management. You even have union leaders that see the union as a business. And so they think of the business they're negotiating with not as a class enemy, not as a fundamentally opposed entity to what they want, which it is. But that's some sort of like, well, you have your interests, we have our interests. And, you know, my unionship, for example, is that kind of business unionist leadership, you know, and they say they have this thing called interest-based bargaining, right? Which really is mixing up the interests of management, which are fundamentally different from the interests of union workers or any workers, you know? And so as a result, every contract, there's got to be concessions, there's got to be low raises, you know, not the first contract so much, because the energy of the union getting in, and nobody knew they had this like secretive philosophy. A lot of union leaderships have these secretive philosophies of variants of business unionism. They don't tell the members about it, because the members would laugh them out of the, what, you know, just wouldn't agree to it. But here, in a lot of places, you know, there's shorthand terms for it, like for these places where the union leadership is more in tune really with management than with the workers that they're supposedly representing. And so you say, kick them out. And that does happen. Union leaderships get kicked out. You get in people that do care more about what the workers want than what management wants, and are more responsive to the workers. And we need that. We need more democratic unions. We need stronger unions. But in the meantime, where that fight is happening, like in the Teamsters Union, for example, it's been going on for years on a national level and at local levels in certain places. But, you know, in other unions, by making a union less active and less democratic, it usually solidifies the bureaucracy, at least for a time. It takes really outside events to shake up the union, including things like the Stop and Shop struggle. Stop and Shop struggle could have this knock-on effect of people's consciousness, not just to organize new unions, which is really necessary, but to shake up old unions where you have a bureaucracy that's ossified, where you have leaders with no vision whatsoever, and they just see the union as some sort of business. And they're doing this thing I started to say a minute ago, the shorthand terms for unions that are called low-wage organizers, meaning they really don't try to make major gains in the wages of the workers. They just want to have union representation, which is always better than not having it. Don't get me wrong. It's always better to have union representation than not having it. It's always better to be in a union than not being in a union. Because at least you have the opportunity or the potential, even though it's sometimes very, very limited at times, to change the leadership of the union, to change the direction of the union. Like West Virginia, for example, the West Virginia teachers went on strike, and that was organized largely around the leadership of the union. They didn't manage to have a quick election to get rid of the leadership, but they did manage to get around them, which is quite a feat. Very unusual, unfortunately, but they got around the leadership through social media and through other ways of organizing, bringing in workers that weren't directly in the union but could help the union and would get something from the teachers union winning something. And they made it a big social, political, union cause and left the union leadership, you know, issuing orders that no one would obey. You know, take this settlement to management, even if it's only 2%. And teachers are like, no, it's got to be at least 4% or 5%. Forget it. No, we're not doing that. Sorry, we're still on strike. And so that's known as a wildcat strike, when workers go out without the, you know, sanction of the leadership of the union. Sometimes it means they go out without, sometimes it goes out when they're breaking the law. And a lot of unions have to break the laws in this country because the laws are written, in the labor laws are written against unions. Everything from Taft-Hartley to things that happened during a Stop and Shop strike. There was a Stop and Shop, there were cops at Stop and Shop, at a Stop and Shop store in Worcester, Mass, where I do a lot of political organizing. And they were saying there's rules about you can't tell people not to shop there. Well, that's not true. There is no rule like that. You know, you can interpret labor law incorrectly and say that exists. And guess what? When it goes the other way, when it's the government or management ignoring a labor law, They say that's not true. When Reagan fired the Patco workers, that was completely illegal. Reagan did an illegal thing. According to labor law, there's no such thing as permanent replacements. You can't do that. And you can't permanently replace workers that go on strike. And yet he did it. And many companies have done it before that and since that. Every public sector worker, practically, in most states, maybe all states, I'd have to research it more, but in most states, it's completely illegal for them to go on strike, yet they have to go on strike. Teachers go on strike, public sector workers, they have to go on strike to win anything. And I can remember in the 70s when they would go on strike and win a lot, 60s and 70s. I can't remember the 60s, too young for that, too old for that or whatever. But 70s, I remember late 70s and into the 80s, teachers going on strike and winning. Then sometime around the 90s, I think, they did get threatened with imprisonment. I only know of one case where anyone actually got thrown in jail. And then here we are, 2019, 2018, 2017, teachers start to go on strike. Don't hear jail being mentioned that much, because when a whole entire state, you know, the union representing an entire state goes on strike and there's high participation, then the the city's affected, the state government, they don't bother unless they're suicidal politically to try to round up all the teachers and throw them in prison. It's like, you know, during the civil rights movement, the strategy of fill the jails, you know, becomes a real strategy at a certain point, or it could become one. There just wouldn't be enough prison cells for, you know, imagine setting up concentration camps for strikers. Like, I mean, that's been done in the United States. 1934, Minneapolis Teamsters strike, they actually set up a concentration camp to put strikers in. It never got filled up. They basically had the leadership of the union in it for a while and some others, but that was, and it wasn't there to, like, murder people systematically, like, you know, Nazi concentration camps, but it was actually a, you know, out, you know, a non-prison, you know, set up specifically for one group of people, and who knows what was going to happen, really. I mean, but the pressure of the strike successfully stopped them from using that for long-term imprisonment or whatever they had in mind. The more crazy of them had in mind of the big business of the corporate community there, corporate leaders there, and state government leaders. But basically, going back to the main thread, Stop and Shop and its aftermath, there's a lot of great effects it can have in existing unions or people wanting to organize a union. And some people have the attitude that when you talk about, if you're a union activist like I am, and if you want to help organize unions like I've done, and other people, of course, many, many thousands, tens of thousands of people are involved in the labor movement, believe it or not, hundreds of thousands actually, you know, organizing. It's very labor-intensive work, organizing a union in a country where there is so much anti-labor, there are so many anti-labor laws, and there's no political party representing working people. In countries where there's a labor party or a communist party or a socialist party or whatever the name is that has some union affiliation, they can push at a political level in a way that is impossible here to do through the Democrats or the Republicans, which are both corporate political parties. Now, some people listening would say, well, no, you can call up the Democrats and they'll help you. Well, no. Most of the time they won't. And when they say they will, they don't. And it doesn't really help. I mean, you had Biden, Warren, and somebody else come to the picket line, and local politicians, like in Worcester, come to the picket line, a couple of them. And some of them were quite blatant that they were just there for vote getting. You know, one guy in Worcester had some pizza and was like, don't forget to vote, you know? And so the workers were like, really didn't like this guy too much. Someone showed up with a Sanders sign, and Sanders, you know, does have policies that advocate for workers, or he talks about them. But he didn't show up to the pickets, and doesn't show up to very many union struggles. And so somebody in Worcester shows up with a Sanders sign on the picket line. Now, it might seem to fit from a certain perspective. Sanders talks about helping workers. I'm going to go to the picket line and hold a Sanders sign. Well, no, you should be there to help the workers. If you want to talk about Sanders, that's fine. You know, but it didn't really fit. You don't try to turn a strike picket line or a strike rally into a rally for a politician, unless it's a labor politician, unless it's a socialist politician or something, and you have a direct connection and they're going to do something for you and you're sure they're going to do something for you. There's been times where Sanders has been invited to high profile strikes, like the Oakland teacher strike that happened recently. He doesn't even, you know, answer, doesn't show up. And he can't be everywhere, but again, he's running through the Democratic Party. So I think it's more like, you know, he's got to watch, or he wants to watch, you know, his image being molded or attacked, and doesn't want to get too quote-unquote radical. Now, showing up to a picket line isn't very radical, in my opinion. In any strike, any union, you have a range of political opinions, because you're trying to appeal to everyone to participate. And you usually get it. You usually get a pretty good response, even from people that say they're conservative, when you break it down and say, well, look, we're on strike for better wages, better health care, protect our pensions, whatever. Even conservatives will, although they'll kind of twist it in their brains to say, I'm just out for this, and this has nothing to do with all that other stuff. Well, it has a lot to do with all that other stuff about organizing unions and socialism and unions coming from being started by socialists, and historically, even in the United States, unions come from the socialist movement and so on. All that stuff is extremely relevant and important, and the further that the labor movement gets away from it, like in the United States, where I know socialists that are leadership of unions, but they usually hide it, and that's a big mistake. I don't agree with that when they do that. And so all that stuff of where the labor movement comes from and the vision of the labor movement and so on is extremely important, because it determines how you're going to act, what you're going to do, you know. It doesn't mean if you're a socialist, organize in a union, either as a leader or a rank and file activist. It doesn't mean that, like some people might think, that you think the union is going to become some sort of revolutionary organization or something. No, it just means you're going to have a union where you're going to push for the best you can get for the members, for the workers, and for other people that rely on those jobs, for the community. You're looking beyond this particular contract. You're looking beyond just the union members, but you're fighting for them really, really hard, and how this is going to affect the labor movement as a whole. And you're trying to get help from the rest of the labor movement. You're trying to get help from the community. Social unionism is a word sometimes people use, a phrase sometimes people use to talk about that, versus business unionism. And that's a big gulf between the two, big gap. And trying to make a union sort of be like the same as a revolutionary socialist party or something like that is not what, you know, a lot of socialists and Marxists are about at all. But to introduce socialist ideas and progressive ideas into the debate and discussions within a union, hopefully they do have those, into the votes, is this the best we can get? Or can we do better with different tactics and so on? That's extremely important. Also, unions do play a key role. Politicized unions play a key role when there are revolutions. They can play a very important role, but it's not because every last union member considers themselves a socialist or something. It's because where the union is at in terms of production and distribution and transport and so on, and they get swept up, correctly so, in a protest situation or a pre-revolutionary situation or a revolutionary situation, they, by going on strike and by fighting, they create the conditions to further the movement or the revolution or whatever. Historically, that's how unions have played a big role in revolutionary struggles. To show that this is not some sort of one-way street, you know, because unions aren't separate from society. The vast majority of people in society are working people. Unions are working class organizations, even if you sometimes have union leaders that jump out of the working class through getting inflated salaries through running national unions or something like that. That's the exception that proves the rule, really, that unions really still are working class organizations. And therefore, if they're not organized from a progressive left-wing perspective, then there's a real chance of being organized from a right-wing conservative perspective. And a real horrible case of that was when the unions in Chile in 1972-73 were used by the CIA in this country to actually take down a socialist government. I'm going to take a phone call here, see what happened. WMFO, you're on the air. WMFO, you're on the air.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
When Reagan fired the
PATCO workers, yeah.
The
air traffic controllers, got it.
Air traffic controllers.
Yeah.
It wasn't against the law.
Oh yeah, it was totally. Because he called them permanent replacements, and you can't do that.
It wasn't against the law. It was called executive action.
Well, that's just a term they use. That's propaganda. That's not law. It was totally against the law. Read the National Labor Relations Act, NLRA. Look it up. You can't have permanent replacements. You can bring scabs in, which is illegal morally, but not illegal in terms of the law. And that's what I was trying to point. I was trying to make that laws against unions.
Supersedes anything.
No, it doesn't. That's propaganda.
Are you following me?
No, you're not following me. That's throwing around the police and the National Guard. That doesn't make it legal. Just like it, slavery was legal, didn't make it right. You know what I'm talking about? You're not getting it. Sorry. See you later. And that's how we deal with that. Because you're going to throw around terms like executive action on this show? Come on, man. This is socialist alternative. This is for working people. Everyone knows it was illegal that what Reagan did. The law is still on the books. National Labor Relations Act. The law is still on the books. You can't permanently fire striking workers. But it's been broken time and time again by corporations. Now, whether they have the backing of some right-wing nut job like Reagan or some right-wing nut job like Trump or some liberal like Carter when he called out the National Guard on striking miners, doesn't matter. Doesn't make it all of a sudden legal, or it certainly doesn't make it right. Certainly doesn't make it moral. So who do you think writes the laws? Give me a break. You're going to cite laws? Slavery was legal in this country. Murdering Native Americans was legal in this country. There's plenty of laws that are completely unjust and should be broken now, right now. There's laws against public sector workers going on strike. West Virginia teachers broke those laws. More power to them. You can't obey laws written by rich people for rich people to create conditions where working people keep going down in their living standards and down and down and down in the race to the bottom because, oh, it's legal or illegal by something. This guy didn't even know what he was talking about. Executive action. Okay, that sounds like something Hitler would do. We're supposed to obey laws, executive action? No, you don't. You don't. You don't obey unjust laws just because they're laws. This is like the people that call in, not call into this show, I'm sorry, people that talk about immigration. Immigration is illegal. It's illegal to immigrate. It's illegal for migrant workers to move across borders. I don't care if it's illegal. It shouldn't be illegal. People have to go where they have to go to survive. That's capitalism. We didn't vote for capitalism. Capitalism is illegal. We didn't vote for it. It's not a law that we passed that we like. All right? But we're suffering under it. We're forced to live under it. So someone has to cross borders to escape poverty caused by capitalism. They have to chase money like we do in this country when we move from city to city, even if you don't cross borders. That's understandable. Those are our sisters and brothers. Immigrants are our sisters and brothers for the most part, except for rich immigrants. And they are, and the immigrants that have to move because of violence in their countries that comes from capitalism, or that have to move because of economic problems caused by capitalism, you don't then vilify those people and don't think you're getting anywhere if you're here. If you're a worker here and you're anti-immigrant, you're not getting anywhere. You're siding with the bosses. You're siding with big business. You're siding with the big corporations. And you're digging your own grave. To be against other workers is digging your own grave. It's suicide. Hope you don't have children. I got children. I don't want to create a future where capitalism is strengthened and the ruling class is strengthened. And they do it by divide and conquer. So when my kids try to get jobs, try to afford college, which is a big joke, how are they going to do that? How are they going to do that? Because already they've turned worker against worker based on immigration or based on racism or based on all the other stuff. Thing about working people, our default position, our where we're at because of where we're at in society is all we have is each other. All we have is solidarity. That's what unions are about, solidarity. And that solidarity extended into the economy means democracy in the economy. It means we're going to start producing things and distributing things for what people need and want, not for the profit of a few. That's what it's all about. So, yeah, if you think a government under capitalism is going to pass laws that are pro-labor overall, laws that are pro-worker overall, you're living in a dream world. It's not going to happen. We can get a workers' party in like they have in other countries, and for a time we can win some laws that are in our favor. For a time, we can win some reforms in our favor. But sooner or later, the capitalists are going to get back together on an international basis, and they're going to go to crush that. You know, in the terms of the United States, Reagan was part of the, Carter actually, and Reagan, were part of rolling back gains that were made in the 60s and 70s by the mass movements that existed then. Labor movement wasn't that involved officially, but there were a lot of union, there were a lot of strikes in the 60s and 70s, there was a lot of agitation in the labor movement, and some unions did come out against the Vietnam War and so on, and gains were made. And the whole point of, and this is well documented, the whole point of big business, you know, sort of rallying itself again when its profit rate started to fall, when the recession of 74, 75 hit, was to bring in people like Carter and the liberals in the Democratic Party to deregulate everything, to follow it up with Reagan and more obvious right-wing assaults on the unions and this executive action that the caller brought up, things like that, break the law for the capitalists. Look at all the laws Trump is breaking, right? For the capitalists, you know. And today it was funny. I was listening to National Propaganda Radio, which is really right wing, if you really listen to it. And they're basically like quoting Pelosi from the Democrats about this infrastructure bill. and Pelosi is and the president of the United States, and all this kind of honorific language, all this language that makes Trump sound like, you know, something special, you know. Because why? Because that's the system. They want to make the president. They want to make people like Reagan and so on look really great and untouchable and powerful. And we're supposed to bow down to them like they're kings or something, when really they're just out there shilling for their class. They're just out there making more money off us. That's their whole purpose. That's what they want. Keep the gold flowing upwards, you know. We're going to get back in the Stop and Shop more directly here in a second. I just got to write something down here because, yeah, that's what we do. We keep track of songs and general topics we talk about. Okay. And we do not have engineers here. We do everything ourselves as DIY radio. Okay, so back to Stop and Shop. Now, I'm going to quote the Boston Globe. Didn't think I would do that in a strike analysis because the corporate media really comes out against strikes hard. And the Globe had its share, or I call it the boss's glob, that had its share of anti-union propaganda during the strike. And it basically had some articles where, you know, they would, like, when I was on strike in the bakery workers union, the local papers inflated our salary, said we had benefits we didn't have, you know, said everything was running smoothly. Stuff like that. We knew better. We knew what we made for wages. We knew what benefits we did or didn't have, and we knew that the factory was not operating well because we saw limited product going out, and we went into the stores, followed the product into the stores, and saw how crappy it was, and did our best to make it crappier while we were on strike. Anyway, quoting from a Boston Globe article, from Tuesday, April 23rd. 2019, they were even within this article that kind of played more to anxieties than reality. It still had some interesting facts in it, and I think the editor might have been sleeping a little bit because it got in a couple pro-union points they usually don't bother. But overall, it's like, you know, you can tell by the headline, post-strike, Stop and Shop and Union face a changed playbook. What does that mean? What does that mean? That doesn't really mean much. You know, they did this thing about pensions, where the company was attacking the pensions. And I believe that the workers held the line on that in the settlement. So the Globe comes in with, well, only a tiny amount of workers in the U.S. have pensions. Here's the direct quote. Only about 15% of U.S. private sector workers have defined benefit pensions. Defined benefit pensions is a fancy way of saying pensions. Money that you get because you worked there and it was negotiated, or the company decided to give it. Because a lot of unions historically have negotiated wages and benefits to the point where other companies, you do the same wages and benefits in order to, even if they're non-union, in order to stop union organizing or to stop... or just to attract people, you know. Sorry about that noise you hear in the background. That's my my personal phone ringing. Anyway, so Globe says 15% of U.S. private sector workers have defined benefit pensions, according to the Pension Rights Center, down from 35% in the 90s. And that kind of struck me. I thought it was higher in the 90s, but it was definitely higher in the 80s. And so you just basically see this downward spiral of pensions. And the reason the Globe prints this is to make it seem like, oh, it's so unique and unusual that they have pensions at Stop and Shop. Well, yes and no. You know, that's still a lot of workers that have pensions. And it's not a special thing. Everybody should have a pension, you know. Then they quote a labor professor at UMass Amherst who said, noting the economic impact of the strike, quote unquote, on Stop and Shop, the 75% of loyal shoppers stayed away during the Stop and Shop strike. And the company was losing an estimated $2 million a day. And that is a good statistic, you know, because a lot of workers aren't in unions and the consciousness is still relatively low about how important unions are, even though polling data shows more people in favor of unions than in the past, which is great. The recent past I'm talking about. These are recent polls I'm talking about. And that, you know, that fluctuates up and down, you know, depending on moods and stuff. But overall, I think there's more people. I mean, I notice it in my daily talking to people, more people that are pro-union, even if they don't have a clue how to go about organizing one or whatever. It's not their fault. Than before, than other times, you know? And it's pretty obvious why with, you know, here we are, supposedly the economy's doing well, quote unquote, if you quote big business, if you quote the corporate media, and yet there's still a ton of homeless people, there's still a ton of people going bankrupt from, you know, health costs they can't afford even if they have insurance. There's still people that are living paycheck to paycheck. In fact, recent data shows more people, in fact, in America living paycheck to paycheck than at any other time. The number of Americans that can afford, well, I won't say any other time, because I'm not sure there's data for that from like the Depression, but I'm just saying like for a long time, when you know when they're comparing polling data on can Americans handle like a $400, $600 emergency without going deeper into debt or losing a home or something like that, that figure is up. The general living paycheck to paycheck thing, a lot of people say that it's basically true, meaning you don't have enough, you don't make enough money to save anything. Back to the effects of the strike on Stop and Shop, again, owned by this big Dutch multinational, not owned by like some local people or something. Big Dutch multinational called, I always screw up the name, Ahern or Ahold. It's not right in this article here, but I think I'll refer to it later. So anyway, Stop and Shop lost an estimated $25 to $30 million in revenue and inventory during the strike. Now listen to that last point, inventory, right? So we're fed this propaganda all the time. I heard it this morning again on National Propaganda Radio on the way into the show. They were talking about, they called it hydroponic gardening, completely run by, they inferred it. They said the planting, the harvesting, and the packaging done by robots, right? In hydroponic gardens. Well, this is something I've actually been researching a little bit, and it's greenhouse gardening is the real name of it, because that's basically what you're doing. You're doing controlled environment gardening under glass in all sorts of countries. It's somewhat automated, some others not. Because it's controlled conditions, you don't need as many workers. But what they didn't say in the propaganda, National Propaganda Radio, is, you know, who maintains the who does maintenance on the robots, their machines break, who does maintenance on the robots, who does all the other stuff, transportation, all the other stuff you'd have to do, who sets the electronic component, who sets the grid, if you want to call it that, that does all the components of the environment within the thing. There's just a lot of different jobs I've found out in that type of farming. It's still there, and those workers are still there, despite the use of the automation, and the automation is extremely expensive to insert, set up, and maintain, and so most places can't afford to do that. Even the bigger businesses will think twice about doing that, and, so it's not this, it's, it, they're always exaggerating how much automation is moving in. There is yeah, automation under capitalism, obviously, since day one under capitalism. We could be talking about the automation of the textile mills in New England in the 1800s. But it doesn't always work out the way they predict in terms of just elimination of jobs or elimination of work, which is the implication. It's a way of trying to weaken the idea that we hold power as workers. When, let's go back to this word inventory. What does it mean that inventory was lost during the strike? It means that no workers were there to get rid of the old product, put in the new product, see if things were fresh. If you're making them, and they do some baking, they do some butchering and Stop and Shop and other stores, and all the things that that you do to keep products, produce, you know, you can get produce in, and if it's not, it'll seem fresh, it'll go bad if the conditions are wrong. They didn't have the workers through management and the few scabs they had to keep things going. And that in itself is a huge, huge power. They even were paying the scabs like, what was it, 20, we heard $25 to $30 an hour or something like that. And thankfully they couldn't get enough and near enough. I mean, when I say not enough, I mean like not even close. So Stop and Shop just immediately closed all its gas stations, closed 20% of its stores. And I think shut down Peapod Delivery Service, which is owned by the big Dutch multinational whose name I need to look up again. So then we got some more info in this Globe article. Several dozen of the 240 stores affecting the strike in Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut were closed. I heard a higher figure than that personally from another source. One of them in Hyde Park was slowly coming back to life, it said. That was when the strike was over. And here's the point I was just making, right? Monday morning, the store was slowly coming back to work. This is after the tentative settlement. As workers swept the sidewalks, sorted through potatoes that had sprouted inside plastic bags, tossed expired chocolate milk, cottage cheese, and sour cream into grocery carts, produce bins and bakery cases were barren, meaning nothing in them. Meat coolers were largely empty, save for hams and hot dogs and other processed meats. Deliveries to, so then they say deliveries to stores had resumed. Again, this is after the strike was settled with a tentative agreement. But the company said it would take a few days till everything is fully up and running. Now, why am I mentioning all this stuff? It was Peapod wouldn't be back until the end of the week. Why am I mentioning all this stuff? Because we're taught every second we're in a, we work, that there's some machine about to take over our job, or there, or that, you know, we're some sort of burden on the company. We're a cost to big business. When really, workers create all wealth. Working people create all wealth. Working people add, if you want to get more technical, add value with their labor, right? Even when you talk about the robots, somebody builds the robots, somebody designs the robots, whether it's high-end labor in terms of payment and training, or so-called, you know, unskilled labor, which actually turns out to be pretty skilled when you have to do it, which I've done it. The unskilled, what people call unskilled, is really very skilled. A lot of people couldn't do it, you know, for any length of time. And all this comes together, all this labor, all this work, is where profits come from. It doesn't come from people sitting in a boardroom and making decisions, right? That sets up the rules. That sets up the parameters of your labor. But within those, you work because you have to. I have to. Everyone, a lot, most people have to. And we create value. We create wealth. And I'm bothering to go through all this stuff about Stop and Shop is because, even Stop and Shop's propaganda during the strike was, you know, we're going to bring in more self-checkout lines. I never use them personally because I hate them. It's just making me do more work, and also takes away jobs and stuff, even though what I'm saying, part of my argument is against that argument that's going to take away all the jobs and all that kind of stuff. But there are corners, there are places where automation can come in, even in the short term, and you know, we don't have to accept it, but we're taught that we do, and we're taught that, you know, our labor is somehow useless or something. And when in reality, we keep things going. Workers run the world. Without labor, without working people running things, things don't run. And that's where our power is, because we can stop things. We withdraw our labor, like this Stop and Shop strike, things stop running. Then it's a question of who controls what. Now, this was a strike in one supermarket chain. 31,000 workers, nothing to sneeze at, big strike. But it doesn't necessarily call into question in people's minds ownership of Stop and Shop. It should, but it didn't. It doesn't. You know, it's not the way it's reported on the corporate media, of course. But we're going to bring that up here, Socialist Alternative Radio. We're going to say, hey, look, if workers do all the work, then why don't we own everything? Why don't we run everything? Really run it in terms of ownership, you know? And we should. And I'm not talking about co-ops and little rinky-dink, little local things. I'm talking about the whole pie, the whole enchilada, the whole everything. We have the power. We have the knowledge. We know how things run. We make things run. We can run, democratically run, through decision-making on a local, state, regional, international level, the whole economy. Of course, not capitalism anymore when you do that. That's called a democratically planned economy. That's the essence of socialism. And you're basically bringing in the people that actually do the work into positions of power, you know, elect your representation at each level, and you decide what's going to be produced in society. In what way do you produce it so you're not polluting the heck out of the future generations, or out of the water and everything else that we need right now? And how's it going to be produced? Same thing I just started to talk about. And then how's it going to be distributed? And distribution isn't just how it gets from point A to point B, but it's whether or not you distribute it for some sort of weird middle person called a capitalist who needs to make profit over doing no work, just telling other people what to work and having guns pointed at their heads, literally. I mean, that's really what it's about. You know, capitalism, when you erase all the so-called laws that can be interpreted one way or another based on who's got the guns, who's got the military and the police and so on pointing in the right direction from the capitalist point of view. You know, forget all the superficial stuff. Forget the laws. Forget the propaganda. Capitalism is a very coercive. It's about violence, is what it's about. Basically, it's about the state, the government reduced to its essence. Is as a famous socialist said, Frederick Engels, the essence of the state is special armed bodies of men, meaning police and other types of organization or to protect. Not to protect, but actually to enforce the rules of a state. And there's all sorts of different governments of states you can have, whether they're, you know, in the beginnings of capitalism, a lot of theocracies coming out of feudalism, and still theocracies like in Iran, or whether they are, you know, this huge superpower of the United States, demanding, you know, access to cheap labor and cheap natural resources all around the globe. So now the gun is pointed at the head of Venezuela to get the largest known oil reserves in the world that are embedded in Venezuela, get at those to be able to use those as they want, as U.S. Capitalism wants to use them. So it's that kind of... It's a system where whoever controls the state, capitalism, it's not the only system like that. All class societies are like that, whether it's feudalism or slave societies. It's whoever controls the whatever sort of military apparatus or police apparatus there is there. They're going to make the rules to enrich themselves, and that's the way it goes until there's a change or revolution where the people take power and democracy decides. And people decide themselves what's going to be distributed, what's going to be produced, and how's it going to be distributed. And again, distributed for human need, so everyone has a better life, everyone has a decent life, or distributed for the profit of a tiny, tiny minority who don't even work, except to exploit. Some of them will, you know, they'll go to a bunch of meetings and they'll be, you know, mapping out with help, by the way, at the top level of it, with advisors and so on. They pay to exploit people, exploit natural resources, to pollute, to make people work for less money if they can get away with it. Like here, you had this $1 billion. They made billions in profits last year, and this big corporation based in the Netherlands decides to slash and burn the pay and benefits of workers at Stop and Shop. 31,000 workers in New England. Go after their wages. They wanted to have a cap of $18.50 on wages. They wanted to cut vacation time. They wanted to get rid of time and a half on Sundays and holidays. They wanted to get rid of the pension, all that kind of stuff. Now, as you probably follow or maybe followed in the corporate media, where did that end up? The way it ended up, this was the largest private sector strike in the U.S. in the past 3 years. I'm quoting now from an article by Ilan Axelbank from Socialist Alternative, and it was the largest private sector in the U.S. In the last 3 years. 11 days long, 31,000 Stop and Shop workers across New England, mainly southern New England, struck against company attacks on their wages and benefits. A tentative agreement was ratified. I didn't get a statistic on the ratification, but the union leadership said unanimously. That's not usually the case. They did this thing in the vote that I didn't really like. It's not unheard of, but they did a vote by acclamation where basically they got people, anyone that came up to the meeting could vote, and they did a vote of, if you like it, stand up. If you like the tentative agreement, stand up. And, you know, that's okay, I guess, in some situations, but I think for a contract where workers should have the contract before they vote on it, study it, and so on, that didn't happen, and then have a vote, even a secret ballot vote if necessary, to really gauge what people think of the settlement, because we know some workers that did not like the settlement. Anyway, the strike did succeed in stopping the company's threat to significantly raise healthcare costs, which corporations are trying to do everywhere. But unfortunately, the contract allowed a two-tier wage system. A two-tier system on wages and pensions between part-time and full-time workers and new hires and current employees. So in other words, with the overtime on holidays, Sundays and holidays, newer workers, new hires after the date of the contract, my understanding is will not get that. And all that kind of two-tier stuff, they call it, is just an attempt by companies to divide the workforce and weaken the union for the next contract battle, which in this case will be in 3 years. And that should be fought. That should be changed. But because you can see where that goes, the first big union that I'm aware of, maybe there were others prior to it, to start that two-tier system stuff was the auto workers union out in the big car plants that they've organized. Many are unorganized, but some are organized. And they gave concessions to management because they didn't want to go on strike, they didn't want to fight, they want to organize, whatever, the leadership of the UAW has been in retreat mode for a long time. They, and concession mode, concession meaning give up on contract, give up on wages and benefits and working conditions in contract struggles and in fights on the shop floor or whatever. And so they basically introduced a two-tier system. I think I was reading about this back in the 90s, but even earlier maybe, but I'd have to double check on that. And they, it's been around for a while though, and got to the point where I knew an auto worker out in Minneapolis who was making $11 an hour in the union. Now, can you imagine working that kind of dangerous, hard, skilled, by the way, even though they call it unskilled, work on an assembly line, building these cars that are each one sold for tens of thousands of dollars and you're cranking out so many per hour. You know, you made up your wages basically within the first 10 minutes you walk in the door, even if you're getting paid a high wage. This guy wasn't. He's getting paid $11 an hour, right? And he's in the union. Now, what does that do? I mean, wow, that just immediately divides the union between older and younger, or older and newer hire, or both. I mean, it's really a divisive thing. You never want to do that. You never want to negotiate away stuff everyone wants to. You want unity. You want maximum unity in a union, right? And the way to achieve that is based on what you're able to get and understanding about what you're not able to get at a given moment or whatever. But at least put up a fight, you know, at least go for it. I'm talking about concessions made on two-tier without any strike or anything, you know? And so the union made these concessions in the UAW and it spread to other unions, and It's often used, you know, and it's really, really bad. It was used in my union, for example, when Harvard University, which has no need to do this, decided to get rid of defined benefit pensions for newer hires, or to switch the way they did that into it wouldn't cost them, quote unquote, cost them as much. They changed the pension system from a defined benefit system to a system sort of in between. One where you didn't have to put money in yourself if you didn't want to, but what they would do on their end is just throw money into the stock market and have these funds manage the money, which you then pay a fee for. So it wasn't the same as the defined benefit plan that you're guaranteed. So if the stock market goes up or down or whatever, you lose money in the money that Harvard puts in, a minimal amount. If you want to make that more through those various things you can open up for, personal retirement accounts, individual retirement accounts, IRAs and so on, then you can do that, right? So you can take your low paycheck, your low check and keep dividing it up and subdividing it more and more. So you get your taxes taken out, then you get your health care taken out, then you get your dental taken out, then you're going to put money into your retirement. Pretty soon you got no cash left for like the rent or the mortgage or anything else. I mean, they think our paychecks are like these elastic things we can just stretch, you know, and then cut little pieces off, and then they're always growing or something, and they're not, you know? I mean, it's just ridiculous what they think they can do to working people. Again, referencing radio this morning, I don't know, I'm referencing corporate radio this morning, they're talking about how to pay for something. I think it was this infrastructure deal they're talking about that the Democrats and Republicans are trying to come up with. And of course, when they talk about the taxes that would pay for it, they never mention, gee, you could just tax the super rich and or the big corporations and have more than enough money for your infrastructure project and then some. No, it's got to be, they start to talk about a gas tax. What the heck? Who drives the most around? It's, of course, working people. We can't afford a gas tax. Gas taxes are already way too high. What, you can't think of any other tax. You can't think of some of the taxes that, that Trump and before that, the Bush administration and the Clinton administration, all those other ones that they rolled back on. You can't think about that. You can't think about reinstating some of those taxes they rolled back on for the rich and got rid of. You know, you can't think about going back to the 50s and 60s where personal income of the rich was taxed over 90%. This is like under people like Eisenhower. You might have heard that before. It's all true, you know. That's not even in the, that's, they don't even put that out there now. They're afraid to mention it because if, God forbid, somebody starts thinking about taxation can actually be more, we can actually have lower taxes as workers and the super rich, who we make their money for them, by the way, and the big corporations who we make their money for them, by the way, through our labor, they could actually pay from their profits, their stolen wages from us, they could actually pay more in taxes. Oh dear, that's just, you can't even raise that anymore. You can't even enter that into the conversation. It's completely insane a lot of time. Now, every once in a while it gets out there, but mostly it's just left out of the discussion. And so then we say gas taxes. And of course, I'm sitting there driving when I'm hearing this. I'm like, gas tax? You're going to raise gas taxes already? What is it in Massachusetts? 18 cents of what you pay is gas tax? It's absolutely ridiculous, you know? We're taxed more than enough. And, you know, if you're a first-time listener or something to this show and you think, wait a minute, I thought this show was about socialism, and here's a socialist talking about lower taxes on working people. Of course, real socialists are for taxing big business and the rich. You know, we're not for increasing taxes on working people. We're for lowering taxes on working people. It's absurd that working people are paying taxes. And for what in this country? What do you get for it? You get a lot of potholes for it. You get mass transit that's a joke compared to the, you know, many parts of the rest of the world, not just in Europe, but other places too. You know, you get, what do you get for it? What do you get for it? You don't get much. I mean, I don't even have sidewalks where I live. I mean, and you know, on most of the streets where I live. So, I mean, what are you talking about? What do you get for all the increased taxes, you know, on us? You know, well, what you get is people losing their houses, you know. Increase, this is the way, this is, I've talked about this in the show before, and I'm sorry to digress here, but let me just digress for a second. You get, how do you get these neighborhoods to be all rich people and all big houses? Neighborhoods that used to be working people. How does the gentrification happen in certain areas, right? Well, there's a lot of factors to it, but one of the main big factors, one of the main big clubs that you, or things that you use to chase people out of a neighborhood is you raise property taxes. You know, you get a certain number of rich people in and they push through property tax increases, or maybe it's a state. Strike that. I'm not going to get into that. I don't think the state can directly, they can pass laws limiting certain taxes and so on, but let's get back to the property taxes. You just raise the property tax to the point where a lot of people, they just can't afford it. They just can't afford to pay that much in property tax, and they have to sell their homes, you know? And then there's, of course, if that's happening at the same time your wages are depressed or your wages are stagnant or you can't find work, like they came out with the latest unemployment figures and they're calling it a victory for Trump, as if one person runs the economy. That's just insane. But the unemployment figures were relatively low, supposedly, except for this little glitchy thing, or not glitch, but it's a little like detail that a lot of people have given up looking for work. More people, that category has increased. So they don't enter the unemployment statistics. Once you stop looking and proving that you're looking, actually, you don't enter the unemployment statistics. But getting back to the Stop and Shop more directly, so I'm going to quote here the article. Despite mixed feelings about the way things played out, this strike is being looked to by workers across the country as an inspiring example of workers fighting back against corporate greed. And that's very, very true. Not quoting anymore. It's very, very true because, like, even if the union leadership pulled the plug a little early, or a lot early, I think, company was on the run, big multinational company on the run, public largely supporting the strike. There was a lot of community support on the picket lines. There could have been more. But basically, What you saw was like the opposite of what usually happens lately in strikes. And it drives the corporate media crazy. It drives the bosses crazy, the big corporate executives crazy. They don't get it. But there's sometimes strikes. Think of the Teamster strike in 1997, I think it was, or 98. I think it was 97. UPS strike. Remember that one? Where, like, starts off typical anti-union propaganda, the corporate media, somebody saying they didn't get their package and how horrible that was and like crying on the air, you know. Usually a poor person, a working person. You always get people to, you always use workers against workers, unfortunately. That just happens. People are too ignorant or too tired or just hoping to get something out of it, or they don't, they're low consciousness, whatever. You can always use that kind of thing. You know, brother and sister stab brother, sister and brother in the back or something. But there's limits to that. You know, there's times where the propaganda starts to be so far from reality that even the corporate media has to back up. And this is one of those times where it turns out, wait a minute, I know those UPS guys. They come to my house all the time. I see them all around. I see those trucks all around. Actually, they've lost market share since that strike. They've lost some routes because of FedEx, you know, breaking the law, referencing that earlier caller, FedEx calling all the workers independent contractors when they're obviously workers and getting away with it because the courts keep backing them up. As a way to, as a club against UPS. But UPS workers all of a sudden were, and that strike seen, no matter what the corporate media did, seen as positive, seen as good people, seen as a worthy cause to support their union struggle, and they won big time. I would argue in the Stop and Shop struggle, despite, again, that early wave of propaganda, despite low consciousness about striking and so on, and despite, you know, there's definitely some people out there that didn't get it, crossing the picket lines and having backward opinions, really ignorant opinions about unions and the picket lines. Overall, I sensed, and I just, everyone I've talked to that's been involved in helping the strike and strike support and so on, that, that there was overall support for the strikers. And that's really, really important. And that, and so that's why I mean, they had the company on the run and they didn't push as far as they could have, in my opinion, and in the opinion of some others, as well. Now over the course of the strike, Stop and Shop lost a whopping $100 million, according to this article by Alon Axelbank from socialistalternative.org. So delis, bakeries, customer service counters all closed. Stores began to smell. I heard that from a corporate media reporter as well. They sent a corporate media reporter into the stores. And I would say still don't cross the picket line, but she crossed the picket line or whatever and goes in. And she's like, couldn't stop talking about how bad it smelled. And you could tell, like, the person interview, you know how the corporate media interviews the corporate media a lot? This was one of those situations. So you had a so-called reporter doing the interview and a so-called reporter just out of the store, and they're talking to each other, which is somehow supposed to be non-biased or something. Anyway, so they're doing their journalistic thing and so-called. And this one, the person that went in the store, just couldn't. I'm sure they really talked to her when she got back, but. To the station or whatever, they're like going into this, like, she's saying how bad it smelled in the stores. It was hilarious, because once again, working people run the world, including the stores. And if we're all aware of that, we all organize together, just a decent percentage of us in certain key areas, we can actually stop things under capitalism and start creating them again under socialism. It's more complicated than that, of course, but that's the essence of our power. So put on full display for all to see the simple truth: without workers, Stop and Shop is nothing. So take that, and I'm quoting from the article, take that lesson and multiply it exponentially across the world. You see why socialists, talk about the power of the working class. Now, before the strike, Socialist Alternative carried an interview with a Stop and Shop worker, flyered or passed out leaflets outside stores in Boston. We had a community meeting in Worcester. I spoke at that community meeting, and it was interesting because in Worcester, because we timed it perfectly, which was, of course, a total accident. No, not a total accident, but it was just one scenario. We timed the meeting for from what we were learning when you know it would happen, maybe just as the strike had already started, or after the strike, or before the strike. It turned out to be the night before the strike, so literally the next morning they were on strike. That was luck, but it was interesting because someone from the crowd at the meeting asked, you know, how do you know if, you know, when are they going to go on strike? If you know, do you know when they're going to go on strike? And I said, well, even if we knew, we wouldn't say in a public meeting, because you just don't don't want to give away that tactical advantage to the company, to the big business, to the corporation when you have the surprise of the strike as an element of the tactics that you can use as a union. Otherwise, the corporation just uses the extra time to try to go out and hire more scabs, to try to think of ways to get